When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
I'm Nicholas Gordon, host of the Asian Review of Books podcast, done in collaboration with the New Books Network. In this podcast, we interview fiction and nonfiction authors working in, around, and about the Asia-Pacific region. When Robert Clive, the man who established company rule in India, was hauled in front of Parliament to answer accusations of corruption, he allegedly responded by saying, essentially, that he could have been worse. Quote, "Am I not rather deserving of praise for the moderation which marked my proceedings? Consider the situation in which the victory at Plassey had placed me. A great prince was dependent on my pleasures. An opulent city lay at my mercy. Its richest bankers bid against each other for my smiles. I walked through vaults which were thrown open to me alone, piled on either hand with gold and jewels. Mr. Chairman, at this moment I stand astonished at my own moderation." The strange thing is that Clive's argument was actually acceptable, according to how many at the time understood corruption. As Nicholas Hoover Wilson writes in Modernity's Corruption, Empire and Morality in the Making of British India, published by Columbia University Press, Wilson uses company rule in India as a way to examine how society's view of corruption changed, from something governed by one situation to a behavior that violates some universal code of ethics. Nicholas Hoover Wilson is a professor of sociology at Stony Brook University. Nick's research focuses on the historical sociology of empires and colonialism through the case of the English East India Trading Company's presence in South Asia. Today, the two of us talk about Clive, company rule, and why this period is a good way through which to understand the idea of corruption.
So, Nick, I maybe wanted to start with the history to kind of set the scene for your examination and kind of a conversation about the different ways to understand corruption. So you're writing about the time of the East India Company and around kind of people like Robert Clive, who I think is a historical figure who has been closely tied to the idea of corruption, and you closely tied to the changing ways we understand corruption. But what's actually going on in this period of time in India and with the East India Company?
Well, I think that's a fantastic way to set the scene. So the East India Company was a joint stock trading company formed in 1600 in then England, and it existed in one form or another all the way down to the middle of the 19th century, so around 1860. And what I find so fascinating about it is that it made a transition from being a largely commercial joint stock corporation. So you could buy a share in the East India Company, and it was largely commercial in the sense that it was constituted in order to trade goods and do speculative trading in South Asia generally. Now, around the middle of the 18th century, and in particular after the Seven Years' War from 1756 to 1763, which in the United States, where I am, is often referred to as the French and Indian War, but in the aftermath of that war, a process of the East India Company beginning to transition from a largely commercial entity over to what we would call a modern state began to accelerate. So even though it was a commercial entity beginning a little bit before the Seven Years' War, it was minting its own coinage, it had its own army, and it was increasingly getting involved in the politics of the dominant political organization in what's now modern India, which was the Mughal Empire. And as this transition happened and the company began to militarize more and more and get more and more involved in Mughal and post-Mughal politics, administrators within the East India Company. These people would begin as the bottom line entry level position in the East India Company was called a writer. The reason that they were called writers was because their job was literally to transcribe documents for commercial documents to send back home and so on and so forth. But as this militarization happens, as the East India Company gets more involved in Mughal politics, they start, in essence, farming out their army, using it as a kind of mercenary army for hire, for different claimants to positions within the Mughal imperial hierarchy. And they do this. The French, who also have an East India Company, are doing this as well. And as this competition accelerates on the subcontinent, it throws the political and commercial order in the area into chaos. Now, why is Robert Clive important in this story? Well, he began as a writer in the East India Company, and he ended up transferring over to the EIC's military arm and becomes very successful as a soldier and rises through the ranks. And as he rises through the ranks, begins getting state-like concessions from the Mughal emperor. One of these ends up being tax administration rights for Bengal, Bihar, and Orissa, which are all states on the eastern coast of the Indian subcontinent. But he also gets a personal prebendal annuity. Basically, they take the tax output from a set of villages just outside of Calcutta, and they assign it to Clive personally as a sort of thank you gift for helping a claimant to the Mughal throne succeed. And this, so what Clive does is he takes all this money, and this is the equivalent to a just stupendously large fortune. He takes this money back to Britain and he uses it to get involved in politics. And one of the reasons that this is so important is that the East India Company has a monopoly for its trade and increasingly its state-like imperial control of India. The East India Company is allowed to trade there. No one else is allowed to trade there. And that is granted by Parliament ultimately and the British Crown. And so one of the reasons Clive gets involved and intertwined with British politics using this giant new fortune that he got is in order to protect his fortune and protect what he perceives to be the interests of the company. Now, why is all of this so closely tied with the idea of corruption? Well, it's because from a modern perspective, sitting here today, we look at someone like Clive and say, how could this man possibly think that what he was doing wasn't corrupt? To accept this very large prebendal annuity, to intertwine his own the interest in his own fortunes with the fate of the company, and on and on and on, this looks obviously like a horrible conflict of interest to us today. This would run afoul of so many standing corruption statutes today. And so I was looking at his biography, and what was surprising to me was not just that he thought that he was not corrupt, but also a lot of people within the East India Company thought he was not corrupt. In fact, once he comes back and gets intertwined with Parliament in the way that he does, the East India Company Board of Directors send him back out to India as an anti-corruption crusader. At the same time all of this is happening, in turn, there are a bunch of people who are shut out of the East India Company's monopoly who begin using a much more recognizably modern language of corruption to criticize what who Robert Clive is, what he's about, and the larger direction of the East India Company. So, who was Robert Clive? Well, he's this important symbol, I think, over the course of his biography of what I call the shift to a modern idea of what corruption is. And so the heart of the book, in my view, is trying to provide a kind of account for how we get to the modern world where we think of corruption in the way that we do. And I use Robert Clive and the story of the East India Company in this period as an account of that transition.
There's a great quote that may or may not have been said by Clive that I want to bring up. But before we do that, I do want to talk about or ask about these two different views of what corruption is. The first being, I guess, the universal view, which I think is closer to our modern understanding of corruption, and then the situational view. And I wonder if you could take some time just to explain, I guess, what these two views of corruption are and how they're different.
Yeah, of course. So we're used in the modern world, as modern people as we are, we're used to thinking about corruption in terms of the violation of some kind of universal rule that is attached to behavior in some kind of space that we imagine to be universal. Now, that sounds really abstract, but it ties to something really concrete. So when we're engaging in what we think of as behavior in a market, where we're buying and selling goods, when we're pricing things, and so on and so forth, there are rules to how a market is, quote unquote, supposed to operate. One of these rules, for example, is don't lie about the quality of your goods, right? Which is to say, don't commit fraud. And something that I think is relatively modern is the idea that those rules should be absolutely universal and apply to any market anywhere. That is a little bit different than the situational understanding, which really depends on a deep knowledge of the particular circumstances in particular places. To continue with the idea of markets, the thought here is that a situational understanding of corruption in market behavior might be, well, your family and my family have been doing business forever, for as long as any of us can remember. We've built up these relationships together. We know that there are particular risks and particular customs in this particular market. And even though we both know that this is the case, you are choosing to still let your greed get the better of you in this particular circumstance. And so even though I can't point to an abstract and universal rule of how you should be behaving in any kind of market, instead, what I can point to is our history and this particular local circumstance and how custom figures into how people ought to behave here. So my point in the book and the main theoretical point that I want to make is that what I call modernity's corruption is the shift of us thinking about the nature of what corruption is from the loss of balance in these more the loss of balance among a bunch of competing impulses in these more situational circumstances to thinking about corruption with reference to these abstract and universal moral spaces like the market, like the public interest, and so on and so on.
So I want to bring up this quote from Clive, which I mean, I've not, is one of these things, maybe he's allegedly said or something, but where he kind of in front of a parliamentary committee, where he says, "Am I not rather deserving of praise for the moderation which marked my proceedings?" You know, he talks about how everyone was giving him money. He says, "Mr. Chairman, at this moment, I stand astonished at my own moderation." Is that supposed to be kind of symbolic of the, I guess, of this more situational view of what corruption is? Is in like, I was in a situation where I could have been much greedier, and the fact that I wasn't shows that I am, in fact, not corrupt.
Yeah, that's exactly it. And even though I actually just got back from some archival work at the National Library of Wales, which is where Clive's papers are, and I could not find that quote, but that's actually okay historically because he did certainly say very, very similar stuff. I sort of set the scene with that because it's such a sort of historically well-known and dramatic example. But you're exactly right that it is an example of this situational, what I call in the book, situational moral order that kind of defines how people understand corruption. And this tethers actually to a really remarkable thing in my mind, which is I mentioned earlier that Clive was sent back to India as an anti-corruption crusader. He was sent back, his quotation is, he was sent back to clean out the Augean stables. He thought that the East India Company administration had grown sort of hopelessly corrupt in his absence. And so the court of directors sent him back to clean it up. But what's really remarkable to me is that what made the administration horribly corrupt, Clive thought, and the directors thought, and other administrators who used a situational moral order thought, is not that people were taking presents. They called them presents at the time. Today, we would just call them bribes. It wasn't the fact that they were doing that. It was that they were taking presents in a way that was exaggerated for their station. They were taking bribes and gifts as lowly junior officers in the East India Company that were too large, were too that represented them getting above their station and violating this carefully calibrated status hierarchy within the East India Company. So what's fascinating, again, this might sort of perk up the ears of a listener today, is not that Clive did not think that taking what we would call bribes today was wrong. What he thought was wrong was doing so in a way that was above your station, was above your kind of location in this hierarchy. And I think that ties very well into the note about being astonished at his own moderation, because later his criticism of other company officials is that they were immoderate, that they lost control of their own greed. And so for him, corruption was that kind of loss of balance among your sort of desire for esteem among your friends, and then your quite understandable desire to get rich and be able to retire with a villa at home in England.
So you note that Clive takes all his money and tries to get involved in British politics, as you note, to protect his own station. How does the UK, or how do politicians in Britain, how do people in Britain kind of, I guess, understand and receive Clive's, I guess, nouveau riche status? There are a couple quite rude political cartoons that you include in your book. On both, I think, on multiple, taking multiple angles on this, but how does this debate play out in the UK, and then how does that start leading to these changing views of corruption that you talk about?
Yeah, that's a fantastic question, because I think that's really the explanatory heart of the book. I think that to put it directly, the understanding of corruption and the way that corruption was thought of in British politics in the 18th century was very much in flux. So there were very recognizably modern understandings of what corruption was. So, for example, there's been some great work done on the excise administration and things like victualling in the Navy and the Admiralty, where it turns out that in these relatively small parts of the British state, you have relatively modern understandings of it being wrong for you to shave money off the top of a contract or something like that. However, in other parts of the British administration, it is still quite common for you to take a major post as, say, some kind of major contracting clerk or something like that as a lord, and then literally just take the money from that position and hire someone else to do your job for you. Likewise, in British politics, this was still the era of what by the early part of the 19th century would be relabeled old corruption, which is to say, this was a system where people would literally purchase the votes of the constituents in their parliamentary seats. There were these so-called rotten boroughs, which were these very small, old parliamentary constituencies that had, say, a dozen voters in them. And what they would do is literally auction the parliamentary seat. So that we're still very far away from what we would call anything like a modern democratic process on that count. Now, on top of this, you're quite right to use the term nouveau riche for someone like Clive. And in fact, there was a whole class of East India administrators who got enriched just like Clive did, although to a somewhat less spectacular extent. And collectively, these people came to be derisively called nabobs. That's actually where the English term nabobs comes from. In American English, you probably would have only heard of this if you've heard Spiro Agnew, Richard Nixon's vice president, spoke of the nattering nabobs of negativism. But in 18th century Britain, it was meant as a pejorative for the term Nawab, which is a Mughal noble. And so this is, in essence, a racist pejorative that attaches the kind of signification of people having been corrupted by participation in Mughal society and then returning and bringing that kind of corruption with them into British politics. And of course, part of this is just sour grapes. This is an old elite reacting to the appearance of a new elite that's participating on their, that's sort of taking them on their own turf. But it's also the case that this is an instance where race and then the moral freight of these two being two very different societies really matters. Because another sort of understanding of corruption that's floating around here is that people can be corrupted not just by bribes, not just by wealth, but also by power. I think it's Acton who said absolute power corrupts absolutely. And the idea here is that the Mughal Empire represented what at the time was called Oriental despotism, which is to say it represented a kind of political organization that didn't have British liberty. Right, which is to say it didn't have the kinds of understandings of personal freedom and personal capability that were seen as being so politically but also morally important in British society. And of course, you might note that it's that understanding of corruption, of this sort of tyrannical loss of understanding of the nature of the moral nature of British society, that intertwined with the same period I'm talking about leads to the American Revolution.
So as you note in kind of your first answer, part of this too is the East India Company kind of moving from being a commercial enterprise to being something a lot more, like a lot more political, a lot more kind of quasi state-like. How does that transformation also link into this conversation about corruption?
Oh, of course. It links very directly, because part of what's happening during this period is that the East India Company is supporting different claimants to different parts of the Mughal Empire. So like a classic early modern empire, there's not a central, there is a Mughal emperor, but the Mughal emperor practically rules through a bunch of subordinates who govern sort of different states in different parts of the empire. And also over the period where the East India Company is coming into ascendancy, the Mughal Empire is also getting weaker and weaker. And as happens in these periods, when empires kind of fall apart, administrators end up sort of saying, well, I'm going to stop paying attention to what the emperor is telling me, and I'm going to kind of strike out on my own as a kind of little king. And so the East India Company, and importantly, kind of factions within the East India Company, start striking side deals with these kind of mini spin-off rulers. And as that happens, they're also continuing to trade, right? So Indian cotton is still incredibly important in this period. Many other different trade goods are being sent back home. And so the East India Company says, well, this is really cool that we've struck this side deal basically as a state with this, say, the Nawab of Bengal. And a key thing that we're going to ask the Nawab to do is give us a tax exemption, right? So basically, because we've allied our military and supported the Nawab of Bengal in his claim to the throne, in return from that, we as the company are going to ask that he not tax any of our commerce, which is an increasingly large part of what's going on in Bengal in that period. But then, of course, certain administrators within the company start saying to themselves, oh, the East India Company has always given us an allowance to kind of trade on the side and make our own money. Well, what we'd like to do is start using this tax-exempt status for our own personal trade. And certain East India Company administrators start saying things like, well, yeah, it's true we all have been customarily allowed to do this, but what you're doing is this gigantic volume of trade that isn't really how this is intended, and it's threatening the overall East India Company's trade. Plus, the Nawab is starting to complain that he's got random European traders who are simultaneously trading on their own accounts, but then also officers for the East India Company running around Bengal abusing his tax officers. So what ends up happening, what I hope you can see, is that it's the intertwining of these state-like and commercial-like things in the context of the transition of the East India Company to a state-like power that create this almost perpetual corruption scandal within the East India Company administration. So there are constantly administrators arguing with one another about who is corrupt and on what terms.
And I guess is that why you see kind of this time period in India as kind of at least one of the points, if not the point, where you then see, as you say, this kind of modern view of corruption really take hold. I guess it's like what, why is this period in India kind of one of the exemplar moments of this, if not the exemplar moment of this shift?
I mean, that's a great question. And there are really two answers. So the first one is, relates to the problem of studying corruption historically. So by definition, corruption in any period, whether it's situational, whether it's universal, is not necessarily something people are going to want to talk about and document really carefully. So it's by nature something people want to hide. And so one reason I chose the East India Company is, you know, I was studying other aspects of it earlier on, and then noticed there are so many accusations of corruption flying back and forth, and people seem so confused about what it is, that this seemed like a wonderfully rich terrain to explore the larger question of how we shift from the situational to this universal mode. But also, you're quite right that the East India Company is a crucial place where this shift happened. This gets a little into the weeds of what they call historiography in the business, which is just how historians argue about the sort of meta explanations that they're making. But there's a lot of debate about where modern bureaucratic administrations come from and the timing of when they emerge. Broadly speaking, there's a school of historians who want to push that emergence way early in history, back into, particularly in Europe, into the medieval period, all the way back to ancient imperial China, as another example. But there's a second class of historians, which I would broadly count myself in, who like to emphasize how what we think of as a modern bureaucracy is really a comparatively recent development. In the United States and in Britain, it pretty much dates to the second half of the 19th century. And one of the reasons that this relates to the East India Company is that the major bureaucratic reform of the domestic British state that really bureaucratized it in a pretty decisive way, which is to say it shifted to, if you wanted to become an administrator, you had to get paid a healthy salary that you could live on, you had to pass a competitive exam, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. The Act of Parliament that did this in the middle of the 19th century was called the Northcote-Trevelyan Report, or the report that spurred the Act of Parliament, was called the Northcote-Trevelyan Report. And Charles Trevelyan, who was the administrator responsible for authoring this report, started as a writer in the East India Company in the 1820s and 1830s, once this universal mode of corruption that I'm talking about had come to predominate within the company, and himself became something of an anti-corruption crusader, but was also accused of corruption himself. And then goes to an imperial career. He's Lord Lieutenant of Ireland for a little while, and then goes back to author one of the major domestic civil service reform reports in Britain. And so the connection is, in other words, I'm saying that the East India Company is so important because it exposes this material in a way that allows us to develop a kind of social scientific explanation of this shift from a situational to a universal idea of what corruption is. But then it also has a pretty important genealogical connection to how the British state administration develops. And also, of course, the East India Company's civil service becomes the backbone of the Indian civil service, which is still the sort of predominant federal civil service in India and allied in Pakistan today. And so just to finish this up, though, I do want to clarify that I'm not proposing here that the East India Company, the English East India Company in India, was the kind of big bang of universal understandings of corruption everywhere and for all time. But instead, I think it's a pretty historically important source, which also lets us see a much more general process up close.
So I guess to kind of wrap the conversation up and to bring us to the present day, you know, it's funny, we're talking about some of these changes in views of corruption, the situational view of corruption, for example, and I admit my thought was, you sure some people still don't believe in that today? Clive's comments on moderation sound almost like exactly like a thing that Trump would say.
Oh my goodness, yes.
It's like how do we still see these kind of like these debates between tension between universal and situational corruption play out in today's conversation? I mean, just to kind of pull an example that came to mind as we were talking, you know, I remember reading a lot of research on, say, business ethics when people act unethically in business, and the answer seems to be it's not that people are kind of innately bad, it's that they're just put in a bad situation and that the context is such that they end up feeling like it's the only thing that they can do. How is this tension between universal and situational corruption kind of still seen today?
Yeah, I think that's a fantastic question. And I think it relates to the modernity in modernity's corruption. So putting this very roughly, there are two different ways that you can think about the term modernity. You can think about it as a period of time, which is to say, we live in the modern era, or you can think about it as a sort of set of orientations to living in the world. We are pursuing a modern lifestyle. And I think one of the really crucial but also really generative ambiguities in modernity is that those two senses of the term collapse into each other quite often. And I think that collapse leads to a conceit that I am uncomfortable with. And that conceit is, well, once you've gotten to the modern era, once you've achieved a modern lifestyle, you've made it. You've gotten to the end. You've gotten to where we all should be. And I think it's much more productive to think of being modern as a fragile kind of institutional accomplishment. So what I mean by that, and let me bring this back down to earth, yeah, I have exactly the same reaction with Trump. I think that Trump is basically a man out of time in the sense that he's acting a lot like an early modern sort of situational actor. And because of that, and because our modern legal and political institutions are oriented towards this controlling corruption, it understood as it is understood in these much more universal terms, there's just this category error with a lot of people who say, well, Trump is just so obviously corrupt by XYZ definition. But the problem with that, of course, is that if you're a situationalist, there are many different situations where his behavior could be appropriate. And then also, even if you have this universal definition of what corruption is, somebody could look at some aspect of any of our lifestyles and point at that and credibly say, well, that's a little iffy. Why'd you choose to do that? And by consequence, I think that the challenge for those of us who don't want corrupt actors running around is to understand that just pure legal definitions or statutes or anything like that are not going to come save us in this instance. Instead, I think the job is to assertively say morally what kind of society we want to live in, why that is a good thing, and then really concretely tether that to the behavior of people that we think are good examples, but also point out how the behavior of somebody like Trump or the behavior of people on the modern Supreme Court or the behavior of people who purchase sports scholarships for their children in order to get into elite colleges, why that is wrong and why that is corrupt.
So I think that's a great place to end our conversation with Nick Wilson, author of Modernity's Corruption, Empire and Morality in the Making of British India. But Nick, I actually have two final questions for you, which are, where can people find your work? Not just this book, but all your work. And number two, what's next for you? What might the next project be?
Oh, thanks. Thank you for those two questions. So you can buy this book wherever fine books are sold, including Amazon, but you can find it also on my publisher's website, which is Columbia University Press. And again, the book is Modernity's Corruption, Empire and Morality in the Making of British India. And I'm Nick Wilson, but in public on the book, it's Nicholas Hoover Wilson. And then my to what I'm working on next. I'm doing a bunch of work on the philosophy and sociology of science right now, and particularly the relationship of history to the social sciences over the course of the 20th and early 21st centuries, but also more directly tied to this project. I've gotten really interested in the resemblance of the model of thinking about situational and universal corruption that I propose in the book, the resemblance of that model to some stuff going on that went on in the history of the United States. So I think the next couple of sort of concrete substantive projects I'll be working on is one related to machine politics. So Tammany Hall and these famous corruption scandals in large American cities at the turn of the 20th century, which I think I'm hypothesizing are going to work in relatively similar ways. And then second, I'm beginning a study of the American Bureau of Indian Affairs, which is now part of the Department of the Interior in the United States, and it's responsible for the interface of the American federal government with the very large number of treaty indigenous peoples, tribal entities within the United States who have signed treaties with the federal government over the course of American history. And this Bureau of Indian Affairs is the arm of the federal government responsible for dealing with those groups. And I'm interested in the fact that they're one of the oldest federal agencies, along with the United States Post Office. They were one of the first ones founded in the new American Republic. And then also that they're one of the most notoriously corrupt agencies in the government.
So you can follow me, Nicholas Gordon, on Twitter at Nick R.I. Gordon. That's N-I-C-K-R-I-G-O-R-D-O-N. You can go to AsianReviewBooks.com to find other reviews, essays, interviews, and excerpts. Follow them on Twitter at BookReviewsAsia. That's reviews plural. And you can find many more author interviews at the New Books Network and NewBooksNetwork.com. We're on all of your podcast apps, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher. Rate us, recommend us, share us with your friends to support us interviewing those writing in, around, and about Asia. Next week, join us for a conversation with Samrat Chowdhury, author of Northeast India, A Political History. But before then, Nick, thank you so much for coming on the show today.
It's been a pleasure.